Moro Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this, even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 105 of the History Hotline. My name is Deanna Lynn Cook, and as always, I'll be your host today. Today's episode is all about a man called Dr. Harold Moody, and maybe from his title alone, you can kind of figure out the work he did. The sources that we've used today to put this episode together are Daniel Whittle's Creating Black Places in Imperial London, The League of Coloured Peoples and Agri House, 1931 to 1943, which is in the London Journal, To Do Something for the Race, Harold Moody and the League of Coloured Peoples by David Killingray in West Indian Intellectuals in Britain, edited by Bill Schwartz, and also Professor Hakeem Addies, African and Caribbean People in Britain, Peter Fryer's Staying Power, as well as a range of websites and online sources in order to put this work together. In the century that followed the abolition of slavery in the West Indies, the region produced many West Indian intellectuals. They were predominantly men and oftentimes spent a lot of time outside of the Caribbean, in either North America or Europe, and most of the time, if they were from the Anglophone Caribbean, it would be in Britain as opposed to another country in Europe like France or Spain. And these included the likes of Marcus Garvey, George Padmore, Eric Williams, C.L.R. James, W. Arthur Lewis, Henry Sylvester Williams, and some of those names you might know from episodes I've already done on this podcast or from your knowledge. And some of them actually you'll find out a little bit more about in today's episode and next week's episode. It also included a range of medical doctors such as John Alcindor, James Jackson Brown, Theophilus Scholes, and of course the focal point and the man of today, Dr. Harold Moody. David Killingray, in his work on Moody, labels him as quite an underrated figure amongst some of these early 20th century West Indian arrivals. And you might kind of agree in the sense that some of the names I mentioned before, like the Marcus Garveys or the George Padmores or the C.L.R. Jameses, you know a little bit more about than Harold Moody, even though they all kind of arrived in Britain at a similar time and conducted their work in Britain around the same time, early 20th century. Harold Moody is perceived as a little bit more underrated than the others. We're going to go into not necessarily why that is, but I think you'll be able to draw your own conclusions as to why potentially that could be the case as you listen in and we kind of get into his life. So, Harold Moody was born in Kingston, Jamaica in 1882, the son of a pharmacist, Charles Ernest Moody, and his wife, Christina Emmeline Ellis, who had little formal education but was a devout Congregationalist and had a very forceful presence in the home. Moody completed his secondary education at Woolmer's School. In 1904, he sailed to the UK to study medicine at King's College London, finishing top of his class when he qualified in 1910, aged 28. Having been refused work just because of the colour of his skin, he was forced to start his own medical practice in Peckham, South East London, in February 1913. And then in March 1931, Moody formed and became president of the League of Coloured Peoples, the LCP, which was concerned with racial equality and civil rights in Britain and around the world, wherever people of the African diaspora were living or situated. Its first members included the likes of C.L.R. James, Jomo Kenyatta, Una Marson, Paul Robeson, and countless others, but we will talk more about the LCP next episode, not this one. So that's kind of an overview of his life, and we're going to get into a little bit more detail about his experiences moving to the United Kingdom. Now, Moody moved to London to pursue his studies and train to be a doctor at King's College. He didn't win the prestigious Ireland scholarship that other people tended to rely on to get to Britain for further education, because at that point, the University of the West Indies had not yet been founded in Jamaica, so there wouldn't have really been an institution for higher education that he could have attended. But what is noted is the fact that when he did arrive in Edwardian Britain, he was completely unprepared for the colour bar that existed, because it wasn't something that was written or spoken about, really. Definitely not in law, like, say, it was in the segregated South in America. It was just something that existed. And if you knew about it, you knew about it. And if you knew about it as a black person, it's probably because you felt it. He found it very hard to find a place to stay. And despite winning numerous prizes during his time at King's, he actually struggled to find work once he graduated. Unlike many other students arriving, especially from Africa during this time period, the interwar years, Moody wouldn't go back home to fight imperialism, and actually only went back to Jamaica on three occasions. So in 1912, 1919, and then 1946 to 47, he devoted his life pretty much to Britain, to serving God and to fighting for the rights of black people that resided and were situated in Britain, and also those of the African diaspora that were spread further afield. He also took on the responsibility of helping his younger brother through his studies through university in the UK as well, and, you know, was an active family man, and once he was married later on and had children, you know, he continued that duty. Racism was so bad at the time that by the time he had graduated from King's and expected to find himself a job as a doctor in a hospital or practice somewhere, he was rejected by the Camberwell Poor Law Guardians, as they said, and I quote, and this is something that's quoted in Friars and Hakeem Addy's books, and it's quoted in different ways actually, but I'll give you the most crude term because I think it's important. It says, "The fastidious poor would refuse to be attended by a nigger." And in the, I think, I can't remember which book it is, I think it's in Hakeem Addy's, it says Negro instead. But I guess the sentiment is still the same. Even the poorest of society, those who are relying on a group like the Camberwell Poor Law Guardians, would not want to be treated by a black man. Even though this black man has graduated top of his class from King's, been educated in Britain, you know, has come from a British colony and for all intents and purposes perceives himself to be English, they would not be treated by him, you know. I always find racism meted out to like doctors and nurses and medical professionals crazy, because when you're in hospital, you're in your most vulnerable, lowest of low position, you know. You are potentially on death's door, in agonising pain, discomfort, and medicine was not where it is now in 1913. So the fact that you can fix your face and fix your lips to be racist to someone that can save your life is just shows how deep racism cuts and embeds itself and worms its way into your psyche if you let it. I find that just outrageous, to be honest. So anyway, as I said, in February 1913, he opened up his own practice in Peckham, basically as a result of not being able to get a job elsewhere. And even though his first week's earnings came to little more than £1, he made it work, and it was an extremely successful practice. And with the wealth and the kind of reputation he built from that practice, he was able to actually support a lot of causes that were working to better the situation for black people in Britain. And we'll get into some of those a little bit later, and also when we think about the League of Coloured Peoples next week. He also got married while in England. In 1913, he married a white English woman called Olive Tranter, a nurse who he met while working in the Royal Eye Hospital in London. And they ended up obviously getting married. They had six children together and had pretty much a long life married together, raising their kids. By the late 1920s, it was very clear to Harold Moody that there was a lot of ingrained racial prejudice and racism that was, you know, in Britain, within British people, and it needed to be opposed by more systemic action and better directed pressure, as opposed to kind of just brushing any individual racist encounters under the carpet. I think he realised that there needed to be like an organised response and a very heavily pressurised response against racism in Britain in order to make the situation for himself and his peers a little bit better. Harold Moody read very widely, and he read across a range of topics, obviously outside of medicine, that included politics, history, theology and economics, and was a devout Christian as well. He kind of was able to see racism through the lens of some of those disciplines and kind of perceive it as a social problem that he was kind of encountering in Britain. He was also quite practically minded and aimed to kind of find ways to deal with racial prejudice and was keen to strategize to do so. As I said, he was looking for a sustained effort against racial prejudice in Britain. So as I said, he was a devout Christian and he was active in the Congregational Union, the Colonial Missionary Society, of which he became chair of the board of directors in 1921. And yes, you did hear that correctly, the Colonial Missionary Society. So I think this is where we kind of understand maybe why he isn't heralded in the same way as some of the other figures from this period. I think not necessarily his religion and being a Christian, but I think the way that he was potentially a little bit bound by that when it came to fighting racial inequalities. And this is all my own interpretation, but to be a chair on the board of directors of a colonial missionary society suggests that there is an element of missionary work and there's an element of like white saviorism that he was very comfortable with. And although those terms are very much modern terms of the 21st century that I'm using to speak on his life in the early 20th, they still have somewhat of a relevance, even though they kind of weren't used then. He was also president of the Christian Endeavour Union in 1936, and often preached. He, as I said, he read theology and made his way to the pulpit on a variety of occasions to talk about a colourblind society, which he believed was necessary for the British Empire to survive. Now, this idea of colourblindness is not one that I like very much. I think it's very problematic to not see colour. If you don't see colour, then you don't see me. You don't, as a black woman, you don't see diversity. You don't see the benefits and the beauty in a variety of cultures and languages and backgrounds and traditions. So, yeah, this idea that, you know, as a defence to racism is being colourblind, for me, that's not going to work. But we are talking about Harold Moody in like the 1910s and 20s. So this idea of being colourblind and him preaching about a colourblind society was important. And I guess it was like a small step for me now, looking back at that. I can understand that in the context of that was the way he was dealing with the racism he was facing. And that's the way he felt he could best influence the minds of those that kind of had the biggest influence on other people that might met out racism to them, that being white British people. So I do understand his perspective, but I don't agree with it, is what I'll say about that. As I've mentioned, David Killen Gray labels him as an underrated figure and alludes to the idea that actually, due to his conservative small c and religious nature, some of his views are often described as a little too conservative. And in some circles, people go as far to label him as an Uncle Tom, which I think is outrageous and unnecessary, even looking back with my 2023 glasses on. However, he was extremely calculated and quite cautious in his approach to dealing with racism in a way that others of his time were not. And so it's very easy to kind of compare him to, you know, the likes of a Marcus Garvey or a C.L.R. James. The politics are just completely different. He is often seen through this kind of conservative lens, and I think that's quite a fair assessment of him, to be honest. Despite the lack of respect in regards to radical politics, he was still the go-to guy for that time when it came to needing support for a cause of the African diaspora. He was known for his, and I quote, charity, comfort, cash and contacts, according to Killing Gray. And there's quite a nice analogy that's used to describe Moody, which is, and I quote, white leftist radicals in the 1930s talked in terms of kicking down the doors of authority. Moody's policy was to knock politely, wait to be admitted, and then to argue for wrongs to be righted. And that is, I think it's such a perfect way to describe him. You've got the kind of left-wing radicals of that period literally kicking down the doors, and Harold Moody knocking politely, waiting to be admitted, and then arguing for wrongs to be righted. So he's not even kicking down the door. He's knocking politely on the door and being asked to let in after the wrongs have already been happening. On the other side, you've got people literally kicking down the doors of authority in the midst of the problems occurring. And I think that kind of really perfectly summarises Moody and the way he was. But also, we've got to understand where he came from. And he comes from a brown middle class in Jamaica. So that kind of plays up to ideas of class, him being of a wealthier class than the average person. And the term brown referring to his skin, he was of light skinned, and Jamaica is a pigmentocracy. It definitely was then and still is today in some senses. And of course, it was a colonial society that was highly conscious of race. And I feel like he was forced to prove his intellectual worth for the sake of the elites on the island, and also in Britain. It was very much a case of, and his life really does epitomise this, that, you know, he was intelligent. He was clearly, you know, able, gifted when it came to books and medicine. And he was going to prove himself to be that intellectual and intelligent man at any given chance and opportunity. Moody did think and believe that any Jamaicans that received a higher education or an opportunity to take up higher education had clear responsibilities, as they had been given their intellect by God and should use it to its full extent, and particularly for human good, which is exactly what he did in his life. You know, he used his intellect to become a doctor, to look after people, and with the wealth he kind of built up doing that, then to go on and support causes that looking at the kind of well-being.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now. Driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and hundreds more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads like this. Even with just 10 listeners a month. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start free at rss.com.
In a situation of African people over the globe, he used it particularly for human good, in the sense of healing people as a doctor and also financially. And then politically as well, when we come to look at some of the work he did with the League of Coloured Peoples and of his own volition. Moody's experiences within the late 19th century colonial Jamaican education system saw him exposed to social order based on colour discrimination. Jamaica was most definitely a pigmentocracy, which prioritised those with lighter skin due to their perceived proximity to whiteness. And that kind of centres on beliefs that are rooted in slavery and the plantation social order. Harold Moody was black. His father was brown, his paternal grandfather being white. However, as a child, Harold Moody's mother, even though she was dark-skinned herself, urged her son to make friends with those who were lighter in colour as a way to socially advance. So it kind of, you kind of understand, like, this is the perspective of his mother, who is a dark-skinned woman, telling him not even to play with those that are darker-skinned because of the kind of social advancement opportunities of being around light-skinned people. Really does highlight just the level of the pigmentocracy, yes, in Jamaica, but also this kind of proximity to whiteness and the benefits of it and the way it's perceived to be very much advantageous. There's a quote that I believe he said, but I'm not sure how far he would necessarily have agreed with it by the end of his life, but did say it towards the early 1920s. And I think it's also the case that the British colonial education system does a number on people that go through it and then arrive in Britain. This is my whole PhD, so I'm not going to go too much into it, but there's an argument that the British colonial education system in the West Indies was an immersion in Britishness. And the curriculum supported this, the people that became teachers supported this, because they upheld this idea that, you know, white people were intellectually more superior and would be teachers, literally flown in from Britain, as opposed to actually training teachers up from the West Indies. I think I would go as far as arguing that, like other men within his generation that also found themselves in Britain, he was brainwashed into thinking he was British, and went even further to try and discard all traces of being Jamaican or of African descent in his mind. And he went as far as saying, and I quote, "I had been educated away from my heritage and towards the country which I had learnt to call home." By home he means England. "My desire then was to have as little as possible to do with my own people, and upon Africans I looked down as a species too low in the rank of human development for me in any way to associate with. I was black, and indeed I was not African, nor was I in any way related to Africa. To what family of man I belonged to, I really did not know. In my heart, I really believed I was English." Don't get me wrong, he did say this quite an early stage in his life, and things did change as he began to get to grips and understand racism and racial apathy in Britain. He began to take pride in his Jamaican and African heritage, and also the idea that there was a common identity amongst black people globally. In 1927, at a missionary meeting on Africa at the City Temple in London, he spoke of, and I quote, "his pride as I contemplate the pit from which I was dug and feel overwhelmed and satisfied to belong to a race which has its whole future to achieve. I have never been more Jamaican than I am today. I believe in Jamaica. As a son of the soil, I want to do what I believe is the desire of every true Jamaican, everything in my power to further the very best interests of the land of my birth." So there's a very big switch up from his initial statements about, first of all, perceiving Africans as too low in rank, which is completely derogatory and just a product of what he's been fed within that colonial education system. It is pervasive. The way in which they look down and they've created this kind of hierarchy of people within the colonies that puts African people at the very bottom. And the idea that kind of he's taken this all in, and to the point where he can't even identify with being African. He doesn't even mention Jamaica by name within that initial quote. He really believes he's English and doesn't understand how he's supposed to relate, and he just can't relate with any other kind of identity. And it really speaks to what the British colonial education system does to your identity, which is something that comes up in my PhD that we're not going to talk about today, to be honest. Maybe another day. But you can see he has developed his thoughts over time. By the time we get to 1927, you know, he is thinking about how he can be the best version of his Jamaican self, how he can do everything in his power to further the development of Jamaica. He feels like he needs to be... He's been taken from this pit, which I would argue where he was a pit, of self-doubt and lack of self-identity and self-esteem. But that's just what education does to you, depending on where and how you're raised. But yeah, I think his initial thoughts, whilst obviously in part, not redacted, he hasn't redacted them per se, but, you know, he's clearly changed his mind. I think these are kind of the reasons why he's not necessarily heralded as a radical, because for a large portion of his life, he really wasn't. And he wasn't even aware of his own racial makeup, and definitely not proud of it, which I'd definitely say is an important aspect of Black radical politics of the time. Now, a lot of the work that he did was within the kind of realm of the League of Coloured Peoples, which was established in 1931, as I said. It's too much to detail in one episode, so it will be next week's episode. But I will talk about, for the rest of this episode, some of the work Dr. Moody did kind of outside of the LCP or alongside. This included campaigning against racial prejudice in the armed forces, which I think I've spoken about on this podcast before, because my first... let's say academic encounter with Dr. Moody is actually when I was looking at Caribbean women joining the Auxiliary Territorial Service during World War II. And actually it was Harold Moody at that point that was campaigning for the colour bar to be removed in the armed forces. I think not just because some of his children wanted to be part of the RAF and be medics in the RAF, but also just because it was wrong to have a colour bar, and he was very much against that. And so that was kind of my first encounter with him outside of just knowing that he was a doctor that had come from Jamaica. He's on one of the borders outside of King's College London. If you ever walk past that part of central London, they have the kind of alumni on all the walls, like notable alumni. And I can't remember where exactly or what campus it is that Dr. Moody is on. But I do remember seeing him when I was studying there. And seeing, you know, being quite proud to see a Jamaican up there as alumni and a notable one at that. So that's kind of where I know him from in the first instance. But also he did a lot of work with the seamen after World War One and the kind of issues that they were facing. He's credited with overturning the Special Restriction Order, or Coloured Seamen's Act of 1925, which was a discriminatory measure that sought to basically subsidise the merchant shipping companies that were employing only British nationals, and it required alien seamen to register with their local police. It's kind of early instance of surveillance of Black people. Many of these people that I'm speaking about, by the way, had also actually been serving Britain during World War One and fighting and being part of the naval forces as seamen. However, many Black and Asian British nationals didn't have proof of identity. They couldn't prove they were British nationals, and so were made redundant. And this leads to like a kind of group of people that are unable to provide for themselves, kind of stuck in Britain. He also becomes involved in the Coloured Men's Institute in 1933, which is founded by Kamal Chunchi, and is a religious, social and welfare centre for the sailors. So basically working quite closely with that community of people in order to better their situation in Britain. You know, as I've mentioned, he is a very influential and respected doctor in Peckham, and he also is part of the organising within the local community during World War II. I think it's Stephen Bourne, the historian, who has said, and I quote, "In 1944, there was a terrible bombing in South London and he was the first doctor on the scene. He played an important role in these events, saving many lives. Yet this wartime history is not known." And I believe it was kind of part of the Blitz that led to a really terrible bombing in a part of South London that he was familiar with. And yeah, he was the first one there, providing medical assistance to anybody that needed it. Not a story you often hear, even though it's quite an interesting one, and quite a warming one when you think about war histories that are also oftentimes bleak and murderous and violin and trenches and like trench foot. That's what, whenever I think about war, just think of like the Wilfred Owens and the Seyfried Sassoons and the poetry and the bleakness and the futility of war. That's what comes to my mind. But, you know, here we have this Jamaican doctor who has essentially been told he will never work in a hospital or practice because he's black and nobody wants him. And yet still continues to support Britain and British people when it comes to the bombing of this area in South London. His family were all extremely successful people, you know, by his own standards that I kind of laid out earlier around intellect and purpose. Charles Arundel Moody, Harold's son, became the second black commissioned officer in the British Army in 1940, rising all the way to rank of colonel. And his other son, Harold, was a British shot putter, actually. And I know that some of his other children as well were part of the war effort during World War II as medics within different forces. His brother Ludlow also studies medicine at King's College London and won the Huxley Prize for Physiology. Ludlow married Vera Manley and then they moved to the Caribbean. And then they had another brother called Ronald Moody, who was a sculptor as well. So all very successful in their own right. It was for 30 years that Dr. Harold Moody would go on and help hundreds of black people that came to him, having experienced the degrading, humiliating and embarrassing aspects of the colour bar at, you know, from his arrival into Britain, and understanding firsthand what that was like when it came to finding somewhere to live, somewhere to work, somewhere to find community. He would advocate for these people, whether that was going to landlords or employers, and always plead the cases of those who found themselves the victims of racism, of racial prejudice and of the colour bar. He was quite opposed to socialism and communism, which again, I feel like he won't fit into the left-wing radicals that we might associate with the period, because he's just not that. He's more conservative and religious. Left-wing political groups often criticised him, as I said, calling him an Uncle Tom and under the control of its imperialist masters, and a lot of Pan-Africanists as well. They often are influenced by Marxist ideologies. Note the absence of any analysis of class from the League of Coloured Peoples, which we're going to think about more next week. But I think there's another element there in his politics to be referred to, as he doesn't interrogate class at all. It's not something he would do, kind of being from the class that he's from. However, in the last months of his life, he undertook a speaking tour of North America and unfortunately died at his home in Peckham, 164 Queens Road, in 1947, aged 64, after contracting influenza. Whilst his legacy may not be as radical as some, he did leave a mark on British society through his work, through the League of Coloured Peoples and his family legacy, which is all quite remarkable, you know, despite him not being left-wing. I think especially positioned historically at a time that's often neglected when it comes to the study of Black British history, and that is the interwar years. We often look to the post-war years and not that kind of small gap of time between World War One and World War Two. Moody was in that generation that did so much to break down the barriers before this idea of a Windrush generation or a Windrush ship was even a thought. And, you know, he would, as well as others in that generation, would ease the experiences of those coming after them and after World War II. So, you know, he can't be forgotten when we think about that legacy, when we think about what he contributed by way of time, by way of money, by way of his talent as a doctor. And his contribution and his legacy is still remarkable, despite him not being remembered as a radical. I'd say it's still quite important to think of him and to remember what he did. And that is all we have time for today on this week's episode of the History Hotline. I will say this episode is being recorded in... Most episodes I record are recorded at the near the time of publication, like maybe a week no more than a week than in advance. But the next few episodes that are coming out will all be pre-recorded, maybe 2, 3, even 4 weeks ahead. That's just because I'm taking a break. So if I'm a little bit quiet, then that is the reason. But episodes will still be coming out because I planned in advance, and they've been pre-recorded. But it does mean that I won't be able to bring in any like contemporary points that I sometimes like to make in episodes. So if you're thinking, oh, she could have talked about that today. Yeah, I was probably thinking the same thing. But for the sake of having a break, I won't be doing that. But I hope you enjoy the episodes anyway. And I look forward to, I guess, not being back live, because these episodes are never live, but a bit more live in the flesh. Thank you so much. Have a wonderful week. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the History Hotline. To continue the conversation, follow us on social media at the History Hotline on Instagram and at the History HL on Twitter. The History Hotline is hosted by Deanna Lynn Cook. Research is done by Zaki Arias.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Boto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
You're listening to a podcast right now, driving, working out, walking the dog. If you're into podcasts, chances are you have something to say too. With RSS.com, starting your own podcast is free and easy. Upload an episode and we distribute it to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and more. Track your listeners, see where they're from, and start earning from ads just like this. If you've been thinking about starting a podcast, this is your sign. Start your new podcast for free today at RSS.com.